Good morning, everyone. We're going to open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Today's Wednesday. We have a number of bills that are set for public hearing and possible work session. The first bill that we have on the agenda is Senate Bill 389. We're going to put that on hold until we have another individual that is supposed to be coming over to give us a little more explanation. So we have a number of House bills that were dealing with child support and other type of issues related. And what I think we'll do is we'll start off with the first one on the list. But before we do that, I do want to just take a moment, as you can see to my left, a gentleman sitting at the end of the dais. That is Ken Hunt. Mr. Hunt is one of my constituents. He and I have had correspondence, and I asked him if he'd like to come up and shadow me for the day, and he said he did. So he's lives just outside of the city of Cottage Grove. And so he'll be with us today. And Mr. Hunt, you'll have the opportunity, I guess, today not to see us. We serve on a similar committee. Senator Dingfelder is the chair. But that's a Tuesday, Thursday. So today you'll be with me when we go over to Commerce. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and open up the first public hearing, which is on House Bill 2272A. And Council, why don't you give us an overview?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2272A comes at the request of the Attorney General of the Department of Justice. I was going to say Hardy Myers, but I guess it would be
different.
Kroger now. It originally pointed that way. Mandates that every child supporter must include a medical support clause, requires a clause to address it. Providing of private health care coverage prohibits requirements of parents to provide health care coverage if the parents' disposable income is less than 150% of the poverty guidelines and other matters as it relates to child support.
All right, great. Margaret, you're set to give us testimony, so if you'll give us your name and statements. And Ronell, I don't know if you're going to be also speaking.
Thank you very much. Members of the committee, I am Margaret Oldham, Special Counsel to Attorney General John Kroger. My portfolio includes all things children. A large part of my agenda has been devoted to child support and the Division of Child Support, which is wholly within the Department of Justice and is part of a federal mandate to make sure that all Oregon families have available child support services. Those services are provided both directly by Department of Justice employees through the Division of Child Support. Those are primarily families who had at some time or currently are receiving public assistance. And then we work in close partnership with the district attorneys who also provide services for typically for families who have never been on public assistance or TANF. This is not a means or income-based program. All Oregon families have the right to apply for it. We have around 225,000 families who are receiving these services, and we are funded one-third by state general. Well, for what we get, we have for every dollar of general funds, we get $2 of federal matching funds. So that's generally an overview of the program. Today, we'll be testifying about this bill as well as the subsequent bills. I'm just going to briefly identify the issue that the child support program was attempting to address and what this bill does. More technical questions can be referred to Ronell Shankle, who is a long, long institutional history, both in the legislative process and in child support program specifically. House Bill 2272A is a bill that does two things primarily. The most important is that it enables us to enter contingency orders that would allow us to put in an original order a provision that pertains when medical support is available. So we're required by the federal government to order parents provide insurance for their children if it is reasonable and accessible. And if it is not reasonable and accessible, we are required to include a provision for cash medical support. The challenge is that people come in and out of jobs, medical insurance may or may not be available, and if we have an order that provides for the provision of insurance, a purchasing of a premium, and then there's a change, we have to go through a lengthy modification process to impose the cash medical support. So we're looking for authority to enter what we're calling contingency orders that would anticipate if insurance is no longer available at a reasonable cost, then in the alternative, this cash medical support will be ordered. There are a few other more technical provisions in the bill to that deal with language to bring it into harmony with some federal law, but primarily the program is looking for this language as a way to be more efficient in processing the modifications.
And Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ron L. Schenkel, also with the Attorney General John Kroger's office, and I apologize for confusing you a bit. We stapled our two sets of written testimony together. So you have the detailed information here from me as well, and I will just add two pieces. This is a follow-up to legislation on a federal mandate out of the Deficit Reduction Act related to our requirement to enforce health insurance coverage for children from 2007, that was House Bill 2125. So this is an existing federal mandate that you have already provided us statutory language on, and as in any new and technical child support laws, we implemented it. We learned some of the things that could make it better, such as the description of the contingency language that Margaret just gave you. The reason this bill is an A and had an amendment is found in sections 10 and 11. One of the things, as we discussed, clarifying the definitions and updating the definitions that we talked with legal aid services about, was the threshold that we were using, and the bill and the statute amends our law currently, which uses federal minimum wage, to instead use Oregon minimum wage, and so that was a negotiation that we made to further enhance the implementation. So unless you have questions, we're just going to stop there and answer anything that you may have.
All right, questions for Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking here. It says minimum fiscal impact, and you indicated it's an existing program. Question I have is two questions, I guess. If we implement the cash medical support, I guess the very first question I have is, you're talking about providing cash in the decree to the custodial parent, and what's the guarantee the custodial parent then spends that on medical services? And the second question is related to the fiscal. If we're providing this and we're income equal or less to the minimum wage for full-time employment, even though you're saying there's no fiscal, if they're uninsured and they don't have a cash medical payment, I mean, they're going to fall under one of, they're either going to be treated as uninsured, which means they're subsidized by somebody else when they go to the emergency room, or the flip side of the coin is they're going to fall under one of our programs, which is going to have a fiscal on it. So can you kind of explain those three things, or are we existing doing it now, or a little technical data, please?
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski and Vice Chair Boquist. The first question has to do with, is there any guarantee that the custodial parent who's receiving a cash medical support order is going to be actually using it for medical, to purchase medical insurance or for medical needs? I think the short answer is that there isn't a guarantee. We do not regulate what custodial parents do, but we do know that custodial parents are often providing medical coverage and would be responsible for purchasing the medication, emergency rooms. The non-custodial parent would no longer have any responsibilities in that regard. Regarding the fiscal issue, and again, this is a piece that is, again, mandated by the federal government that we include in there. And in calculating the guidelines, we're also assuming that we're imposing an assumption that the custodial parent also has to be contributing towards medical insurance, and the guidelines kind of reflect, would go down based on her or his obligations to be providing cash medical support for the child as well. The other piece relating to the fiscal, this is not really a change from historical practice, so it is a technical fix, but it is not going to, I don't believe, substantially increase at all the sort of the burden on the public. In fact, if anything, we're hoping that this is going to decrease the burden on the public, because we're going to have in place a more ready ability to both require insurance to be made available when it becomes available without having to do a modification.
Let me go back to the order, the child support order. If we're already doing this, the question I have is that in the order, does it specify, for example, you have the child support order, and then is it broken down in the judgment that says, and this amount is in addition or as part of for health care?
Yes, it does.
Last question, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
And I'd be happy to discuss offline, but I'm still a little concerned about when we change the numbers, and I know the technical answer from LFO is there is no fiscal, but it gets much more complex to that when you increase from the federal to the state minimum wage in 150 poverty and the LRO impact as it goes across. So I think while there's no fiscal impact, there is an economic impact, and anybody that's uninsured still gets treatment when they go to the emergency room. And I'm so a little concerned about how we're tracking that. I'm not saying it's right, wrong, or indifferent, just a little trying to get educated in anticipation of House Bill 2009. So,
Chair Prezant,
discuss offline with you.
Chair Prezant, if you wish, I can do a very brief attempt, and then we may need to go offline. It is very confusing, and we had to have a lot of dialogue with LFO when they looked at this bill because it's not new. We are currently in Oregon under the laws that you gave us last session doing this now. We look at a child support order, the original order or the modified order, and we calculate in one of two things currently because we're required to. Either the cost of health care premiums, if you will, to use standard lingo, and factoring that in, or if there is no insurance at the time, the cost of the availability of additional cash payment to cover the cost of the things that Margaret mentioned, like prescription copays, emergency room visits. That exists now. Our definitions will tighten that up a little bit, and what occurs with that minimum wage threshold is not specifically in the enforcement end, but in the upfront calculation where we determine how much they can pay towards those cash provisions. So it's happening today. We should not necessarily see a large increase in people needing additional state assistance. In fact, we think this will help because of that contingency language where we will be able to, in a more expedited manner, flip back and forth between the types of plans they have and enforce it more readily. So we're hoping that it will actually be better than what it is today. And again, we're happy to meet with you afterwards.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Kuczynski. First question is along the same lines, the follow-up with Senator Boquist. I would wonder if you could provide to this committee, or to me at least, a comparison of the 150% of federal poverty compared to Oregon minimum wage. And also, how do we resolve that federal minimum wage is not indexed and Oregon minimum wage is indexed, so Oregon minimum wage is a moving target. And then the other question is, in LFO report here, it says it clarifies that a last issued child support judgment does not supersede an earlier support order unless it specifically states that it does. That's kind of bizarre language. I wonder if you could expand on that as well.
Chair Prezantski and Senator Wittsett, we will certainly get you the actual numbers of current federal and state minimum wage and follow up after this hearing today. The second piece I think you mentioned about the moving target, so to speak, of minimum wage, we have rulemaking authority in this area, and we have a specific calculator that assists our program as well as practitioners with calculating these amounts, and any time it adjusts, we adjust our rule and our calculator to meet the current need without being out of compliance. The third piece, and I apologize, can you refer me back to your third question? The superseding language, I apologize. That is basically to say that when we do a modified order, we may, for example, in Senator Boquist's example, we may have a dissolution between a couple originally, and then we're modifying it down the line. There are all sorts of provisions in that divorce decree that we're not modifying, and they stay the same. But very specifically, we are modifying your support amount and your health insurance or cash medical amount, and those then go forward based on our new order. So that's language to ensure that we're not modifying the entire judgment, but anything in the new order does, from that point forward, prospectively, become the new supplemental judgment amount.
Oh, please. So we have a judicial order in a divorce with a child support mandate. This would allow the Department of Justice to change that without going back to court. Is that correct?
Chair Prasansky and Senator Whitsitt, in essence, that is our current law, and we don't go back to court, so to speak, and appear in front of a judge, but the law that you gave us several years ago in the administrative process says this: if we're modifying our own order, then we do that and file it. If we're modifying an underlying court order, a judicial order such as a dissolution, we go through the entire process with the parties, and at the very end it goes to the judge, and the judge has, I believe, 60 days to approve that order and finalize it. So ultimately the court does touch it and make it a modified order, but we do all of the upfront work.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? I just want to put on the record, from reading the presentation or the written material from Margaret, it says that we are funding one-third from the state funds and then two-thirds, so that's where we get every dollar we put in, we're getting $2 back from the feds.
That's correct.
And then it also talks about 5 federal performance measures and 4 state performance measures. And I didn't see those really delineated. Can you just give us an overview, or is that something that maybe you'd want to put in writing as to what those measures are and how they're actually accomplished, in the sense of do the feds come out on a periodic basis and reviewing our documentation, or how does that work?
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. It would be easy for us to provide you with that information. It is on, it's publicly available. I would note that the medical support order piece is a performance measure that is going to be implemented by the feds, which is not currently, but we are ahead of the game to make sure that we are going to be in place to meet the federal expectations in terms of having orders that include medical support orders as well as then enforcement.
I would just add, generally, we will certainly provide you with our performance measure report, but the existing measures that Oregon has adopted for the child support program mirror our federal mandated performance measures, and they're basically in the areas of paternity establishment, the collection of current support, the collection on arrears, the establishment of orders, and cost effectiveness. And all child support programs nationwide have those same standards, and then we will have the addition of the medical. So those are existing, and the way that they are measured is through a process called a self-assessment report, and then we report federal numbers to the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement, as do all of the states, to ensure that we're meeting the minimum threshold, which Oregon does, and then actually progressing, which Oregon also does.
Okay, and so I assume that based on our self-reporting, at some point they do some type of review and can come back and audit on some type of periodic basis?
Chair Brzezinski, that's correct.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Ladies, what I'm going to do is I'm going to first let me see if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2272A. Not seeing that, I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to go ahead and open up my public hearing where I have legislative counsel here because I need to get him back to work downstairs. So we'll close this hearing. I'll open up a hearing on Senate Bill 389. Counsel.
Committee, Senate Bill 389 comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary, and it repeals RS 127.721, subsection 1. And this relates back to the special session, the House Bill 1087 from the special session in February that was Measure 57 on the ballot. And the purpose of this is to make the statute consistent with what we did in Measure 57. And when I saw today that we had a question from one person about possible amendment, I asked Mr. Prinz and Kristen Aspie to come and help us through this to testify.
Okay. So I'm going to open up the panel for whoever wants to present, because I understand, Katie, you have something that you want to bring forward that may be some type of amendment to the existing bill. And then I know Josh and Craig responded to some initial emails that we had earlier in the session just as for clarification as to what SB 389 was scheduled to do. So we'll let you present, and then we'll follow up with any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Craig Prinz, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. I'll let Josh and Katie introduce themselves.
Katie Suver with the Marin County District Attorney's Office on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association.
Good morning, Josh and Nassie. I'm the Deputy
Legislative Counsel's Office.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Taylor did a good job of explaining the background of 389. If you go actually back to 2005, when the meth package was passed, that did a lot of different things, most notably the control of the pseudoephedrine, creating the drug court grants and those things. It also did some sentencing changes around delivery and manufacture of methamphetamine. So that was in 2005, and then, of course, in February of 2008, the legislature passed Senate Bill 1087, which was a referral that became Measure 57. And so this statute here is what was passed in 2005. And Josh brought to my attention, as we were running fast in February, working on Senate Bill 1087, as the legislature worked on that, that we had to go back at some point to clarify basically the overlap between Measure 57 and how it relates to traffickers of heroin, meth, and cocaine. He was saying in February, we need to go back and make sure that this is clear in the statute. What is the governing law? And so I can let Josh then explain what the language does.
Sure. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. I think the short answer is that the italicized language in the bill states that the court has the authority to impose less than the presumptive sentence under certain circumstances. Section 6 of what became Measure 57 provides that when a person is convicted of a manufacture or delivery of a controlled substance other than marijuana, and the person has a prior conviction for the manufacture or delivery of a controlled substance other than marijuana, the court is prohibited from imposing less than the presumptive sentence. So the only other thing I would add is that I think that the amendments in Senate Bill 389 do not change existing law. I think when a court's faced with both of these statutes side by side, they're going to say Measure 57 was adopted later in time and therefore controls.
And preempted what was there prior from 2005. Okay. And Katie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I completely agree with everything that Josh indicated to the committee. The only suggestion that the DA's Association is made, and I'm here on behalf of one of our members who actually made this suggestion, is that we simply make it clear in the statute by inserting the words except as provided in, and then cite the statutory language for Measure 57, when a court sentences a person convicted of their essentially third delivery of methamphetamine, the presumptive sentence is 19 months. And that's the only amendment that we're suggesting be added. I will also point out, however, to the committee that subsection on page 2, line 4, the statute as it currently reads does indicate that the court may impose a sentence other than the sentence provided by subsection 1 of this section if the court imposes a longer term of incarceration that is otherwise required or authorized by law. So while that section does, I believe, otherwise cover what Measure 57 will capture, and that is super substantial quantities or subsequent convictions for methamphetamine, it was at the suggestion of one of our members that we simply add that language in for clarification.
Okay. And Katie, let me ask that suggestion. That did that come in prior to or after the bill passed the House, if you know?
I don't know. I'm sorry. I got an email a couple of days ago. Somebody asked, can you come down? And I'm assuming that it would have come in, the suggestion would have come in after it passed the House.
All right. All right. Questions? Comments? You're off the hook. So I guess before you do that, Josh, based on the suggestion that's being made, I know it is not routinely, but it is not unprecedented to put that type of language in. What would be the position of LC as to us doing that or not doing that?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, I guess we'd be neutral. In addition to the language that Ms. Super pointed out, I think page 1, lines 26 and 27, it refers to convictions under 475, 890, or 892. And I think the super substantial quantities, when they're codified in the next version of the ORS, will have separate numbers, so the super substantial folks won't technically be sentenced under these statutes. Long story short, I don't think it's necessary, but I don't think it causes a problem, and if it adds clarity, that's not a bad thing.
All right. So I'm going to kind of look at my committee and think whether we need more clarity or we want to go with what we've got. In other words, do we want the amendment that's been suggested or not?
I'll defer to your good judgment on that, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you very much.
So, make a
all right, I'll make a decision. So, Josh, if we were going to have that amendment, when do you think you could have this back, and how does that work into your case and your load of work that you got right now?
I think it's a fairly simple fix. It's just a question of identifying the relevant sections in Measure 57.
Why don't you go ahead and get it drafted? What I'm going to do is I'll talk to the chair on the House side and see if that's something that they would be amenable to, but we'll go ahead and get the amendment done. So if we're going to do it when we go to work session, we'll have it. All righty? Oh, it is in the bill. I was looking at the House bill. Okay. So, yeah, let's go ahead and get the amendment. All right. With that, I'm going to go ahead and ask first if there's anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 389. Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing. And thank you all very much for appearing today. And we're going to go back to our other bills, which are all House bills. And at this point, I'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2273.
Chairman, the committee on 2273 comes before the Department of Justice and applies the license suspension provisions to all support enforcement matters when child support payments are in arrears, not just ongoing cases.
And when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Olney. I'm Special Counsel to Attorney General John Kroger, and included in my portfolio is the Child Support Program, which is the Division of Child Support that's wholly within the Department of Justice. We have before you today House Bill 2273, which is a bill that would allow us to use the license suspension enforcement tool in those cases where there is no current child support obligation owing. That is, a child, the children are emancipated, are no longer, are out of the home. There's no longer support owing currently, but there are arrearages, and we would like to be able to continue to use this tool to collect on those arrearages. The issue has arisen often where a parent has entered into a compliance agreement. So our goal, to be clear, with license suspension is not to actually suspend the license, but rather use the threat of the license suspension to obtain a compliance agreement. And it's been quite effective in allowing us to do that. We've had cases, however, where the day after current support stops, the obligor says, sorry, you no longer can use this tool, and they stop paying. And we want to be able to continue to use the tool to collect on those arrearages. That's the essence of the bill. There are some specific details in my testimony regarding the number of cases that potentially could fall under this. That's going to be up to our discretion. The child support program predominantly wants to be able to use this so that our current licensing and compliance agreements do not stop the day a child emancipates.
And Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ron L. Schenkel, also with the Attorney General's Office. Just a little bit of background by way of a reminder. The Oregon Legislative Assembly gave the Child Support Program a pilot license suspension program before it was a federal mandate in 1995, and we were actually ahead of the curve on using this enforcement tool in Oregon. In 1997, as part of the welfare reform child support provisions, you then gave us the full license suspension process that we have today. And it includes suspending licenses of all certificates, permits needed for professional occupations and driver's licenses, as well as recreational licenses, which we have defined in Oregon to mean certain types of hunting and fishing. Because this was such a strong enforcement tool in 1997, there were concerns about it being used too heavily, and so we have a statutory threshold that an obligor must be at least 3 months of support or $2,500 in arrears before we even look at using this tool. We did not apply it at that time to arrears-only cases for similar reasons. I think that over the years, we have demonstrated what we have been saying since 1997, which is the goal of the program is to get people to contact the program, stay in contact, and make regular payments. The goal is not to suspend a license because then everyone loses. The person is unable to drive. The person is unable to work. We use it to get the attention of what we refer to as the unwilling to pay obligors, not the unable, not the poor, not the people having difficulty, but the people who perhaps are self-employed and choose not to make payments and often hide their assets. This is a good way to get their attention and keep their attention. As Margaret has explained, we do use lose the ability to use this tool oftentimes on cases where there are still significant arrears owed to the parent who in the meantime over the years had to support the child using a single income. The only other thing I will mention is that in the House Judiciary Committee, we also had testimony from Deputy District Attorney Carl Stecker, and I think the only difference in the point that that they would make in the portion of the caseload they see is that last point, which is they have a lot of private cases, never any sort of state assistance involved, and they hear from these obligated parents, from the custodial parents that they really need this debt paid back to them and returned to them to offset the costs and expenses that they accrued over the years. So we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions. We're going to start with Senator Bonamici, Senator Wissett, and then back to Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that you did say that it's not your intent to suspend the licenses in your testimony, written testimony, and in your oral testimony. You are familiar with my constituent, Brett Artevison's case, and his professional license was threatened. I did receive an email from him about this bill. He was very concerned about it, and I wonder if you could sort of address the situation, what you do procedurally to make sure that if you're threatening someone's license, that it is in fact because of that particular person's non-payment, not because, as you recall, in his situation, it wasn't that he wasn't paying, it was that his employer wasn't paying. So if you could sort of outline what steps you would take if you ran into that situation again to make sure that it isn't applying in that scenario should it happen again.
Chair Prosonsky and Senator Bonamici, that is a very good case example, and I guess I would start by saying it unfortunately was Murphy's Law, where on a case where something can go wrong, several things did. When I say that our goal is to get the attention of the unwilling to pay obligors, we do first initiate a notice to the parents once we know that there are licenses for a particular individual to let them know that we believe they meet that threshold, that statutory threshold of the 3 months or $2,500, and to say you really need to call us. I believe that's the notice that Mr. Arvidsson received from us. In that particular case, our process failed us, quite honestly, because the license suspension notices are not one of our expedited computer-generated notices, but they are a notice that involves a caseworker looking at a case, and we failed to acknowledge that he was saying payments were coming in. We were not seeing payments coming in and making that initial phone call to the employer and following up on that. It did ultimately get remedied, but Senator Bonamici is correct that we did send out that notice, and I'm sure it was very distressing to that constituent. There is a notice. It is absolutely intended to get them to contact us and have dialogue with us, and then we make individual case decisions from that point forward based on the case scenario. Each case is individually apprised.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Prosonsky. As you know, I've discussed with you before, I do not think it's an appropriate sanction to remove licenses from people when they're unrelated to their child support. I just don't think that's an appropriate deal. It has no bearing on the right to drive or the right to practice medicine or whatever. In our district, there's been several cases in the last year where licenses to drive have been suspended, and once the obligee has come to terms with the Department of Justice, the Department of Motor Vehicles has required up to 90 days to get a license back to them. I don't know if that's true of other licensing agencies or not. So whatever your intent is, it appears to me that your outcome is that you deprive them of the ability to earn the money to make the payment. And it just, to me, it's unconscionable.
And I'll blame Senator Dingfelter for pointing this out to me. So. I'm taking time here. I was looking at the testimony here, ladies, and it says 46,000 cases are in arrears right now. That's a huge amount of cases. Can you give me can you give the committee an outline of what's the total number of cases you're dealing with now? And I mean cases or orders. What percentage is 46,000 to it with the effective unemployment rate at 19.7% in the state? Are we seeing the caseloads go up? And the second portion in here, can you take a, and I know this would be purely subjective and not objective, but take a crack at the number of these cases that involve self-employed or self-employed contractors in relationship to the unemployment numbers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Chair Prozonsky and Senator Boquist, a series of questions, so tell me if I miss any one of them. In our testimony, the 46,000 arrears cases are not, unfortunately, the total of cases that do have a debt in the system. As Margaret testified earlier, we have approximately 225,000 cases in our caseload overall at any time, and many of those are in arrears. The 46,000 are cases that are in arrears and would meet the qualifiers of 3 months or $2,500, so we've narrowed down that total. Arrears only, correct. There are many cases that have arrears and still have ongoing support.
Yeah, that, before you go further on that, because it does say arrears only, so we have 46,000 arrears only. That means that they have no, they're not future obligations, or they're only behind on the arrears and they're current on the others, because that's that 200,000 plus, right?
Yeah, Chair Brzezinski, that number represents a parent who has no current obligation for ongoing accruing current obligation for a child, but had failed, that had arrears based on failure to pay the child support amount historically, and then that is moving forward. That arrear, that number is not going to be increasing.
Right. The number is 46,000 right now. On the next line, approximately 6,600 are qualifying, meaning they are in the point of where they are in arrears at least 3 months or longer and could have the suspension imposed if the agency department chose to go that route.
Chair Brzezinski, that's exactly right.
And then following over to the next page of that same number, we have over $100 million that is out there owed, which is represents at least 3 months of arrearages or more.
Chair Brzezinski, that's correct.
All right. Please continue with the other questions Senator Boquist had.
Margaret started to answer the second piece, which is that arrears basically and most commonly accrue based on a parent not paying at all during a month or not paying a complete monthly obligation, and so they slowly over the years of 18 or 21 years fall into greater debt. There are some scenarios, although we have worked with you over the years to remedy as many of these as possible, where sometimes people get a new order right at the beginning with some arrears or some past support owed. For example, if you go to get divorced and it's contested and it takes several months, you may start out with a small debt based on the judge's determination, but that is not by any means the significant number of cases and why they have arrears. And then I apologize, I lost your third question.
So what we're saying, make sure I clarify and then I'll do that. We have about 225,000 individuals that are paying into the system, for a better word. 46,000 of those are in arrears, about 20-some percent of them. And then the correlation I'm looking to that is we have a 19% unemployment rate. Contractors, of course, aren't in the unemployment rate because they're not eligible for those numbers. They're self-employed, and I'm kind of going back to Senator Whitsett's deal in the middle of a depression here. Do we have a rising number of arrears? What's the number? What's that a rising amount? And the department has to, of course, recognize the 19% unemployment rate. And if you take a license away from a contractor or something, when the economy does start to recover, they're not going to be able to earn any money.
Chair Prozonsky and Senator Boquist, in answer to your question to clarify, there are a total of 225,000 cases in our caseload. Some of those don't have orders yet. Those are new cases where we're establishing orders, and so on and so forth, and we can give you all of those numbers. Specifically to the economy and what we're doing, I believe it is our next bill that you may be hearing that Ms. Olney is going to talk about an exciting new program that will deal with that very question. So if you don't mind, if we could defer that over, you're going to see some statutory language related to that.
Yeah, economic impact.
Right. All right. So, Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have another question because it was raised when Senator Whitsitt asked his question. Based on your testimony, your intent is not to suspend the license, but it sounds like sometimes you do. And I wondered if you could talk about how often that happens and what's the procedure for that, if you, in fact, suspend licenses.
Chair Prozonsky and Senator Bonamici, first of all, I apologize. I have page 2 and a missing staple of page 1, so I can't give you, but I will follow up the number of suspensions over a one-year period, for example, and the number of compliance agreements, and that number goes back and forth constantly. But the process I can speak to, which is this. There are times where we send out that notice and the obligated parent still doesn't contact us. They're just avoiding their obligation completely. In that scenario, we do then issue a notice to the agency holding the license, whether that be Department of Transportation or some other occupational board, for example, and that agency then sends out their notice under their statute saying your license is no longer valid until you resolve this with the Department of Justice. That often will get us a contact, and at that point what we do is talk to them about a compliance agreement. It's a negotiated factor. It's done person to person over the phone, and once they sign that and start making payments, then we issue the notice, which is what Senator Whitsitt was referring to earlier, back to the agency to say they're in compliance and let them have their license back. So we work immediately with them to get a payment agreement in place. We are doing follow-up, and I apologize that we don't have that resolution for the Senator today. He asked us earlier about the time frame that it takes specifically Department of Transportation to reinstate, and we still need to follow up with the committee on that.
Let me follow up on this, though. Ronell, when that notice goes to whatever agency that holds the license, does that agency just send out the notice, or I'm going to call it a notice, to the holder of that license and states that at this point your license is suspended, or do they say we have received notice from DOJ that you are in arrears and you have 20 days or whatever? Is there another step of, let's say, where they can actually come and redeem themselves before that license is actually suspended?
Chair Prozonsky, I believe, I'm not familiar with every licensing agency at this point because I'm a little bit removed from the work at this time, but I believe most agencies that issue licenses also have a statutory requirement to give notice, and so technically there could be a second notice. What I don't know is how often those sort of happen concurrently and how often it's a particularly two-step process.
Okay. I would be interested in getting the answer to that question. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Good. Yeah. And then I think the other part on this, I know, like in the prosecution side, if you have someone have their license suspended through DMV, they have to go to the court. The court gives them the paperwork, and then it's basically the onus on that individual to then go to DMV, present it, and then they should be able to be active and live immediately so long as they can pay whatever reinstatement fees and stuff.
Right.
So I'm assuming that is how it would work in these other situations.
Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee, I think just 2 points of clarification on that. I think that, one, the licensee will have a right to a hearing, an administrative hearing, in addition. So they do have that right. And then part of the issue, I think, that related to Senator Whitsitt's constituent may be that when somebody is driving without a license, they then, and they get cited for driving without a license, there's another step of a sanction that is not at all in our control.
All right. The other question I have is regarding, let's say the action is taken, the person does lose their license, whatever their license may be, how much does the individual actually have to pay to be eligible from the department's perspective to have that license reissued? And specifically, I understand it takes at least 3 months of arrearages to lose your license. Would they only need to come back in compliance of only being 2 months behind, or do they have to clear the complete arrearages, or I guess it's a plan to do so? And I'm trying to figure out how much discretion does the department have, and is it equitably being administered to each and every individual and not, let's say, too discretionary as to who gets and who doesn't?
Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee, I'm not familiar exactly with the rule. There is a license suspension rule, which is OAR 137055 4420, And it says that the amount is that which could be obtained from an income withholding order pursuant to ORS 25.414. So there's a framework that's in the rule that creates a presumption, which then can then be rebutted, and there is a fair amount of discretion in order to come up with a reasonable plan for payment.
Right. So really, it's the plan that we need to have in place once the agency's, let's say, confident a plan has been put in place. We don't require, let's say, some type of demonstration on the part of the licensee to, let's say, comply with that plan before they may be eligible to get their license reinstated?
That's correct.
Okay. Other questions?
Mr.
Senator Boquist.
Just a comment to follow up to what you were saying, and I guess for record, whatever, but obviously we need a process in which to, you know, try and improve the situation. But as you pointed out, Mr. Chair, you've got to go to court to solve something that costs money, and they're unemployed or they're self-employed and don't have money, and you have to go through the administrative procedures regardless of which 120 agencies we're talking about or set of rules, because we have that in another hearing or another bill we're working on. That costs money. I don't have a solution, Mr. Chair, but it seems to me we're going to have a growing problem as unemployment rates continue to rise and self-employed people don't have jobs. So I don't have a solution, but this doesn't sound exactly, at least at this point, what it is.
All right. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know I'm getting a little bit ahead on the agenda, but Department of Justice has an amendment to 2275 that Ronell Shankle alluded to. And what I understand right now, there's an assumption that your child support would be based, minimum, based on a minimum wage job. Because in the past, in every community, there's been at least minimum wage jobs. That's not the case now. So they have an amendment that would, on 2275 that will address that issue.
All right. Well, we'll get there. Let me ask if. Is there anything else you'd like to say, Mark?
May I just clarify two last things on that quickly? The scenario, Senator Boquist, that Chair Prozanski gave was, I think, acknowledging other processes. You do not need to go to court to negotiate a license suspension in any manner when we are the initiator, unless, as Margaret pointed out, you are cited later for driving while suspended, which is then a separate traffic court issue. All of the negotiations are with us, no costs involved other than an agency reinstatement fee if they have one. And then on the recession information that we'll talk about under the other bill, this tool will not be used on those cases. These are the people that we believe have assets and are not willing to make payment.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, because we've heard this, we have another bill revolving the administrative procedures and civil procedures, and there are costs involved for once it gets to the point of trying to reinstate those agencies, so on and so forth, which is not at the Department of Justice, but other agencies, right. Just for a point of clarification.
All right, so why don't y'all stay set there for a moment. Let me just see if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2273. Not seeing any. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2273. Open our next public hearing on House Bill 2274.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2274 comes to you from the Department of Justice and modifies the laws relating when the Department of Justice and the District Attorney may refer a child, a spouse, support, or arrears to the Department of Revenue for collection.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Margaret Olney. I'm Special Counsel to Attorney General John Kroger, here today to testify in support of House Bill 2274. This is a bill that has been necessitated by a federal audit of the Department of Child Support, of our program, which found that youths who are in closed custody at the Oregon Youth Authority do not qualify for the federal matching funds. They're not what we call 4D qualified. We currently collect child support from both parents for children who are wards of the state, either through the juvenile justice system or through DHS or foster parents. And the challenge is, and we collect that and then we give that money to the respective agencies. In the audit, because the small population of children who are in closed custody, who were essentially incarcerated, did not qualify, that meant that our efforts to collect those monies were not subject to the same kinds of protections and authority that we currently have under law for using a variety of provisions, including tax intercept. So we have committed to continue to provide this service for the Oregon Youth Authority in terms of collection, and even though we're not getting federal match funds, but we need this bill in order to give us the authority to use the tool of tax intercept, because our current statutes only authorize us to use that on cases that qualify for 4D coverage.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, Ron L. Schenkel with the Attorney General's Office. I'm not going to add anything to the technical aspects of the testimony, but I will share with you that in the House Judiciary Committee, when we pulled some numbers, what we found is specifically for these types of tax refund intercepts, the program collects over $1 million a year, but more specifically for the Oregon Youth Authority, the revenue that we generate to offset their costs was over $37,000 in 2006, $85,000 in 2007, because remember we had additional kicker refunds, I believe, and almost $17,000 in 2008 at the point that we had this data. So it is a significant amount of money for their budget.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. It's my understanding that the Oregon Youth Authority maintains incarcerees up until 25 years of age in some cases. Do you have an age limit on this?
Chair Przanski and Senator Whitsitt, the way that that child support works for any youth, whether it be a youth or a youth offender in the various programs in Oregon Youth Authority, is under our basic child support laws. So child support in Oregon continues until age 18, and if they're in a program with an OIA that qualifies that they're still getting their schooling, it may go to 21. It does not continue to age 25. That's a separate law, not related to child support.
Just a clarification. In school means if they're still like trying to obtain a GED or something up to 21 years of age, or does that mean in higher education?
Chair Przanski and Senator Whitsitt, under, again, the statute that applies to all children in Oregon for child support, it can be higher education, but that has to be defined by the entity, and I must confess I don't know currently whether or not Oregon Youth Authority has the ability to provide higher education services to the youth. If they are and if they meet the criteria in ORS 107-108, then yes, we would continue support.
So in any case, it would end at age 21.
That is correct.
Any other comments?
Just so that I understand, because I looked at the bill for changes and I don't see anything in the bill understanding what they're saying. So basically, by eliminating this clause in whatever statute it is, it takes out the federal and says on the state side we can do this now.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I had to call Ronell Champlin and walk through the thing for the same reason, right?
Okay, yes. Got it. All right.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the bill and go, well, what's changed? And you see just one bracket area, and that's the magic. All right, any other questions or comments? All right, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 2274? Not seeing anyone. We're going to close the public hearing on 2274. We'll open up our next one on 2275.
Chairman, 2275 also comes to you from the Department of Justice. It clarifies that a person eligible for receiving assistance pursuant to 504 Section A of the Social Security Act is presumed not able to pay child support. Chair, members of the committee, you also have the A2 amendments in front of you, I hope. And this is the one we talked about earlier that allows the Attorney General to declare a period of significant unemployment and allows the Support Enforcement Division during a period of significant unemployment to suspend and modify a child support order. It's in response to the current economic circumstances.
Whoever wants to start off.
Thank you, Chair. The committee. Again, for the record, my name is Margaret Olmley, Special Counsel to the Attorney General, here today to testify in support of House Bill 2275. As we've already heard, there are significant amendments that are being proposed to this bill to allow us to respond more nimbly to the economic recession. What I would like to do is first let Ronell Schenkel review the more housekeeping, that part of the bill that has already been through first chamber, and then I will come back and explain the amendments and what we're looking to do.
So Chair Prozanski and members of the committee, for the record, Ron L. Schenkel with the Attorney General's Office. Because you have my written testimony that delineates section by section what our changes are, I will not walk you through. I will be happy to answer any questions other than to tell you that sections 1 through 6 are purely what we often refer to as housekeeping. They're removing or adding language to clarify that the way the laws work in Oregon, both for the customers in our program as well as for the practitioners using these laws. This is an amended bill, so I'll point out to you that Section 7 is what was changed in the House Judiciary Committee, and in brief, what that addition was to amend a statute that is not a child support statute, but ORS 412.024. It's a temporary assistance to needy families statute to mirror our child support statutes, with some good news for families, which is beginning this next fall, one more phase in piece of the Deficit Reduction Acts for Child Support will be implemented, which is when a family goes in and signs up for TANF, they will not have to support, in brief, they will not have to assign their support for any arrears owed to them at that point to the state. They'll only assign their current support, so more money will be going to families. Representative Kotek had a similar bill to fix this in the House chamber as well, but passage of the 2275A will in fact meet that need. So that's what happened in the first chamber, and I will answer any questions if you have anything on the technical provisions. Otherwise, we'll talk about the amendments pending before you today.
All right, let's go to A2s.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. These amendments today, we are requesting the authority to be able to respond more quickly and effectively to the economic recession, because as Senator Boquist, you know, so rightly identified, unemployment is high. And it is very difficult if it takes an extended period of time to get a modification of a child support order. Arrears accrue during that time. Obligors feel, incredibly burdened. Behind the evidence is pretty clear that if arrears are accruing, if support is set too high, the obligor becomes discouraged, may stop paying, and it's simply not fair. So our goal is to devise a system that will encourage, will facilitate a speedy modification of a child support order in light of the current economic realities. What we are seeking, this is one piece of a larger project that will involve some emergency rules and other provisions that we already have the authority to do within the Division of Child Support. But let me walk you through the basics of what we are asking for here. First, this would only apply during a period of significant unemployment as determined by the Attorney General, with a start date and then with an end date. In making that determination, we provide that the Attorney General may refer to the unemployment statutes and whether we are in a period of extended, in which extended benefits are available. That is a known factor. The Employment Department, the Director of the Employment Department, makes that determination. We want the Attorney General, we don't want to be turning on and off from another program, but our intent is to use that as sort of a starting point to determine whether or not we're in a period of economic recession. Second piece, then, is that we are looking for the authority to suspend the current support order and replace it with a temporary modification that would be in place for 6 months, would expire by operation of law unless renewed, and this would be for employment-related losses of income. The reason we would like to have this be a temporary modification is that historically the challenge in setting support if there's been a job loss is that usually people get a new job in a couple of months, and we don't want to have to modify for 1 month and come back and modify again next month. So our rules and our policies typically assume that every obligor, actually every parent, because child support is calculated based on the presumed income of both the custodial parent and the non-custodial parent, we assume that both parents are able to at least make Oregon minimum wage full base at full time, and that currently is simply not the reality for many low-income folks, so we will be looking at using actual income. The other piece our rules currently presume is that somebody who has a higher-paying job, we set support based on potential income, based on the historical income that party has received. Again, that's a presumption. The party is always able to say, I'm not going to be able to do that, but that the starting point is that we make that presumption, and we're going to be temporarily using actual income as opposed to those presumptions during this period of economic decline. As part of this project, we are also looking at simplifying the modification process, speeding it up in terms of service and notice, attempting to get agreed orders, and again, by having these modifications be temporary, we're hoping that the obligees, the custodial parent, who knows that he's not making it up, that this is a period of economic decline, might agree for a period of time to a temporary modification, knowing that that's not going to be forever, and they don't have to go through the 6 to 8 month process of a permanent modification. So this bill essentially gives us that ability to do a temporary modification for 6 months and then an expedited process for either renewing it or, in the event the obligated parent, the obligor, becomes employed as and is therefore able to fulfill the support obligations in the original order, that temporary modification will be rescinded.
Chair Prozanski, I'll just add then a point of context. Margaret explained everything we're going to do, and she mentioned this will involve a series of emergency temporary rules to adjust what we currently have in our guidelines, to adjust what we're doing with the medical support, and ultimately the way that we collect during this period on these cases. I have been in the child support program since 1989 and have been on our 4-year guidelines review throughout those years. And even with the downfall of the timber industry, it has never been to this point where we're struggling so hard to calculate support for families and strike that balance of supporting the children with something but not leaving the obligated parents with nothing. You're going to hear from one of our constituents, actually, and Representative Thatcher's constituent, who is in this very scenario and is working with us as a prime example of what we would like to be able to do with these families. Here's what it might look like in really simple terms if you haven't dealt with child support calculations. You may have an order with us right now, 2 children, $400 a month, based on your prior income earning history. And now you simply can't work those many hours. Perhaps you lost your job altogether. You're on unemployment. You're on workers' compensation. Any of those things might occur. If you contact us today, we put you into that full modification process that Margaret referenced. If you contact us after we have this law, which, by the way, this amendment requests an emergency clause just on this provision, not the rest of the bill, in the future, hopefully, we would then be able to put you into a different process run by a specialized team of workers that are currently doing full modifications. They'll do these types. And based on your actual income, as Margaret said, maybe you're going to end up with $100 a month accruing during that temporary period. So in our accounting records, we'll stop accruing at $400, we'll start accruing at $100, and we'll start collecting based on that lower amount. In 6 months, it will go back to the $400. Everybody will get notice and will know that that's going to happen. And if the scenario hasn't improved, we can extend it as needed. So we're looking for flexibility to cover all the scenarios that are just now starting to come up for these families and the ones we haven't even seen yet. And we're hoping that you will support us.
Questions? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to kind of understand the authority level to the Attorney General, and you raised an example which I'll come back to. And first, you pointed out that obviously we're in an extended period of significant unemployment because we're at 19.7 on the U6 rate in Oregon right now. That's very clear, and we understand that scenario. I guess a question related to that, I'm assuming when you do these calculations, or you would do these calculations, you could look at the level of unemployment benefits they get plus the, for example, the other assistance they get, and then you calculate a number. That's question one, to confirm that. The second one, when you say significant
significant levels of unemployment. I'm assuming, based on the testimony you just gave, that hypothetically, and I'm saying hypothetically, that something happened in the timber industry or laws change or something, and a large number of just timber people were put out of work. Then that is something the Attorney General would look at and say, this segment of the economy has a significant level of unemployment, and these rules might apply to them. And I'm only using the timber industry as an example, simply because you raised it.
Okay. Chair Brzezinski, Senator Boquist. On the first point, on the second point, which is closer in my
first
brain.
First point, yes.
The first one was yes. The second is that we would be able, and we actually currently have the ability under administrative rules to recognize that in particular industries or times that our presumption about what one might be able to earn would be different.
Okay.
So that we would be able to address that.
Okay. And on the first point.
I think that was a yes.
That was a yes.
Yes. Okay.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Boquist, in essence, what this does beyond the guidelines, as Margaret mentioned, is gives us a slightly different expedited process, which we didn't have during the timber industry downfall. We were still doing full modifications.
All right. The only other thing I want to add to this, and Ronnell, thank you for putting on the record that it does have an emergency clause that would be for this part here. I'm assuming, even though it states in the amendment on page 4, what the Attorney General would be doing is determining a period of significant unemployment, and what he, in this case, would be able to look at to determine whether that's occurred. I assume there's going to be potentially other factors, so that tells me there's going to be some type of emergency rulemaking to actually get this up and running. Is that correct?
Chair Brzezinski, that is correct. We already have a team looking at a temporary rule that would supplement our guidelines but address these scenarios.
So as soon as, let's say, this goes through and the governor signs it, we'll be in the position to really implement the temporary rule and have whatever proceeding that's necessary for a permanent rule?
Chair Brzezinski, that is our anticipation. It would be temporary and it would be emergency, so we could do that with the archives very quickly.
All right, and I think all of us in the room realize that the significance of that's happening in the counties. Senator Boquist has been, very diligent in following the unemployment. There are six categories, and I'm just shocked every time each month he actually has the complete run done, and as he has in the, I'm going to call it the catch-all, category six, you know, it's almost 20% average for the state. And so that means for many of us, we have counties that are not only double digits, but over 20%. So, Senator Wissett and then Senator Boak.
I just can comment on unemployment. We have at least two counties in Oregon, Creek County and Harney County, which with our errors, 9% added into it, are right at 30%.
Right.
Right.
I just wanted to point out, Mr. Chair, that I pulled the statute that's referenced in line 20 for determining whether there's an extended benefit period under unemployment insurance. And it looks like there's some guidance in there. I notice it's a discretionary may consider, but its inclusion in the bill makes me think that perhaps this will set up some guidance framework.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, that is exactly our intent. We do not... we're not wishing to reinvent the wheel.
All right. I have other people who want to give testimony on this one, so I'm going to ask you to please clear the table. And Representative Berger, I see
I'm
that you're
here to speak on bill.
Okay. You're
so
just
hoping to come here and remember
to conversation. Okay. Looks like
you
called her.
Please release her at some point so
I
she
will.
Can return. Christopher, Bryant, why don't you come on up? And Donna, it sounds like you may want to be up here as well.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Don Phillips, Policy Director for State Representative Kim Thatcher, District 25. And I want to introduce Christopher Bryant, a constituent of Representative Thatcher's from the Kaiser area. Christopher came to us a couple of months ago in pretty dire circumstances, and it's only gotten worse, unfortunately, for his situation. Christopher is one of the little guys we've been talking about today, one of the obligers who's kind of stuck between this rock and a hard place, trying to put food on the table for his family as well as meeting his obligation to his six-year-old daughter and the child support that he owes on a monthly basis and some small arrears. And due to his work circumstances, even in December, the garnishment that he had for his child support left him with zero take-home pay. So the garnishment Grinch got him right before Christmas, and I don't think he had much for Christmas for his daughter as well. Representative Thatcher wanted to do something to help, and under the current law, you're only allowed to take 50% of a monthly paycheck for a child support garnishment, and so we drafted a legislation, House Bill 3189, to reduce that to 25% if you fall below the poverty line. We got to talking with Ron Allen, some of the good folks over at the Department of Justice, and they mentioned that they were working on these temporary rules and working on this legislation, and we felt it was a perfect opportunity to combine forces and see what we could do to support this legislation. And so Christopher felt very strongly about coming today so you could hear what he's going through, obviously not the only one in the state. So Christopher, would you please introduce yourself to the committee?
I will. Thank you. My name is Christopher Bryant. I live in Kaiser at 609 Greenwood Drive Northeast. And I am not unlike many people in our area, in our state. As a court order, I am ordered to pay child support. In that, I'm ordered to pay medical insurance toward my daughter. As was previously spoken, once the health insurance is taken out of my check and taxes and all of that stuff, it leaves me with basically nothing in order to help support my family that I currently have. And it, granted, it's just my wife and I, but I have an obligation to help put food on the table. I have an obligation to help pay the bills. I have an obligation to help provide transportation to and from work so that we can both work. And if I can't do that, then I'm not meeting my needs at home as well as elsewhere. In the tough times that we are now experiencing, the hotel that I was working at laid off a host of people, and I was included. And as a result of the layoff, I am having trouble obtaining unemployment benefits. And I currently have a request in for benefits, and I'm waiting for the state and the county to respond back. And as a result, I'm not able to contribute anything to my daughter in child support. As well as I'm not able to provide anything for my current family. And it is definitely a hardship when I go to work and I'm not able to bring home the money to support both entities. It's even harder when I have zero and I can't do it and I'm still acquiring those arrearages and at the same amount I was working full-time. And I just respectfully ask that you give this bill consideration.
Christopher, thank you very much for coming forward. I know that you had an opportunity to at least glance at the -2 amendments, which is what we've been talking about, which I assume Representative Thatcher's office has been working with the Department of Justice. Does it seem to, let's say, carry your intent as to giving the flexibility to the agency to be able to work with yourself or others in similar situations?
Yes, it does.
All right. Questions, comments? Thank you. Yeah, thank you very, very much for coming forward and being patient to be here today and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 2275? Now I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. I'm going to open up our last public hearing for House Bill 2277. And Margaret and Ronell, if you'll come up, I'm just going to caution everyone. We have about 7 or 8 minutes before we're supposed to be concluding. And so if we can stay within time frame, that would be great.
Thank you very much, Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Olney, Special Counsel to Attorney General John Kroger, with responsibility for oversight of child support. House Bill 2277 is before you today. We ask that you support it. It is a bill that would, much like our this would enable us to create orders, enter orders, that would anticipate physical custody flipping between one parent and the other. And many times, many families, they would have a child, perhaps a teenager, who is going to live for a year with mom, next year might want to be living with dad, and currently support the support order has to have be fully modified when those circumstances change. Again, taking time, there will be credit in that circumstance when a child has when physical custody is different, but it creates a significant hardship, and we are looking and time and expense for us, frankly. So we are looking at being able to enter orders that would anticipate that change physical location of the child that essentially could be turned on and off by agreement with both parents. The parents would have to agree that the physical custody has actually changed so as to invoke the alternative support amount. And this bill simply gives us that authority, again, an effort to be more flexible and efficient in responding to the changed circumstances of our clients.
And Chair Krasanski, members of the committee, for the record, Ron L. Schenkel with the Attorney General's Office. I will just add that you're used to having us come before you to talk most often about enforcement tools or federal mandates and hearing about families that don't get along and don't work within the system. We have a whole lot of families that are cooperating with one another, even though they're not together, and do work with us, and this is a service that we can provide to them to work with them to make the system more streamlined. Certainly there are times where parents make agreements to perhaps during the summer, an extended period, change physical custody, and they really don't need the time, the money, the expense of going and changing that underlying custody order in court, nor is it convenient for them to go through our full modification process, not once but twice. So this would expedite that. Our guidelines already use the income of both parents. We're well laid out in our rules to be able to do this, and we simply need your authority and your blessing.
Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you. I just have a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For either of you, what, I'm assuming you did the research for this in preparation for the bill, but what percentage of cases would you say would fall into this category?
Chair Prozanski and Senator Dingfelder, I apologize, I do not have specific numbers, and the reason for that is we do code modifications into our system, but we can't tell the type of modification. I will tell you it is not a significant number of parents to our knowledge, but for those that it is a significant amount of time, and therefore it's a multiple use of state resources and delay for the children.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just to follow up to Senator Dingfelder's question, when I was a state rep in the last term, I probably had 6 or 7 cases like this come before me in my single house district. Yeah.
So my understanding, I guess, really, this is kind of on a consensual terms that the parents are, let's say, not only they're working together, they're in agreement that we need to do this shift. So one of them actually petitions or comes forward, and then based on the records you already have, or whatever supplemental information they may give will dictate this changing of the order, the amount that would be required, et cetera.
Chair Prozanski, that's correct. It would require us at the first instance, because of this new law, to modify the order to add this language, but then in the future it would be in place. And certainly either parent at any time can make the request to us, and the difference is if they make the request and the other party agrees that this is what's occurring, we'll do this expedited process and add this language, and if the other party does not agree, we'll do a full modification like we do today and let them have their hearing.
I just wanted to get that on the record. Anyone else?
Hey, Mr. Chair, in the cases that came to my district, it was, you know, by the time both of them hired lawyers on both sides, went to court, got scheduled, everything else, any money that would have been saved or transferred was gone.
Right.
Or so the child lost out in both cases, actually.
Right. All right. With that, let me see if anyone else wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2277. And I see the representatives back here fishing. We had one catch and release, and I'm going to release the whole committee so you can go for all of them. Whoever she's after, you may want to exit another way. We're adjourned.